Good afternoon and welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm your host, Brian Lanzone. Coming up on today's episode, whether it's an owl, a deer, or a possum in distress, Pacific Wildlife Care is there to help. The group is dedicated to rehabilitating wildlife and returning orphaned and injured animals back to their natural habitat. Marisa Waddell will talk with Pacific Wildlife Care about how they help animals on the Central Coast. Also on today's episode, part two of our Ears on Art conversation with Cuesta College teacher and artist Bob Pelfrey. But up first, correspondent Tom Wilmer interviews retired Democratic United States Congressman Kika De La Garza and retired Republican Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell. They reflect on their careers in a time when bipartisan relationships and partnerships were the norm rather than the exception.
The current paralysis in Washington, D.C., with the government shutdown and the inability to communicate across the aisle, got me thinking about two recent interviews with governmental officials. I recently spent time with 89-year-old Kika De La Garza and his wife in their home in McAllen, Texas. Kika served 32 years in the United States Congress as a Democrat. And then, 2 weeks later, I had the good fortune to meet and interview retired Republican United States Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell. Come along and join me for a conversation with Kika De La Garza and Ben Nighthorse Campbell as they reminisce about their careers in Congress and the Senate, a time when cross-aisle consensus and communication was the norm. Retired Congressman Kika De La Garza was born in Mercedes, Texas, September 1927. His congressional career spanned 32 years from 1965 through 1997. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a conversation with Kika De La Garza. You were there in Washington when LBJ was president, weren't you?
I had campaigned for LBJ when he first ran. We knew each other, say we were friends. When I was elected to Washington, he was in the Senate.
So in 64, you both ran at the same time then, together?
Yeah, I ran for Congress and he ran for the president.
Tell me what you felt about LBJ as a politician, as a person.
From the beginning, he was a good politician as far as running for political office. But one thing was that he never forgot who helped him in the beginning. Another thing I liked about him was he never looked down at you.
In a sense, he never really lost his common roots from when he was a teacher then.
No, I don't think he did because, he worked his way up to leader in the Senate, and you could talk to him one-on-one.
Think back about when LBJ was president and some of the legislation that you think is most important to the 20th century.
Oh, my gosh. Medicaid and Medicare. Medicare was, the number one piece of legislation that he supported, and I was fortunate to be in the Congress to vote for the original Medicare bill.
So let's go back to the Nixon years. That was a very interesting time in American political history, wasn't it? What did you think of Richard Nixon?
I would consider him a friend because very interesting. Anytime we were at the White House, he'd get me off to the side to speak in Spanish with me.
Tell us about Ronald Reagan in those days.
I say we had a friendly relationship, not only as congressman and president, but as friends.
Can you think of anything else relative to his administration that is memorable in your mind?
I think what I remember the most was that when he was speaking to you, he still speaks eye to eye, but he looked down at the notes. I remember that the most.
Always an actor there, his cue card.
Right.
Going forward, Jimmy Carter is probably one of the more maligned presidents that a lot of people feel did not get the due respect and honor that he deserves. Your thoughts on Jimmy Carter?
Jimmy Carter was a very nice gentleman, very kind, quiet, unassuming type. Again, also, he always looked you in the eye and would speak to you as a normal person one-on-one. I think history has not been kind to him, because he was a good president, because he worked with the House and the Senate. He worked the one-on-one very, very, very well. I think that was what impressed me the most about him.
As you look back as a retired congressman and you watch the goings-on in Congress and the Senate today, what are your feelings? What do you think about what's going on?
Well, I hate to say it. Most of the time I say, what in the world are those guys doing? But it's vastly different from my service there to now. Plus, the issues have changed, and the Congress, House and Senate, have changed. Doesn't feel the same. Looking from outside back, I don't feel that there's the same camaraderie.
Per, you talk about consistently today is a bipartisan camaraderie, an ability to cross the aisle and talk to one another in a civil way and work together.
When I was on the Agriculture Committee, I started at the bottom all the way to chairman, and the Republican ranking member, Ed Madigan from Illinois, and I got to be very good friends, so much so that I went to his district and campaigned in one of his campaigns. A good Democrat says, what are you doing here campaigning for a Republican? I said, because he's my friend.
You don't see that much anymore.
No, you don't see the relationship anymore between House members and Senate. There's a divide that seems to be unbridgeable.
Kika de la Garza, former United States Representative from Mission, Texas, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it, and I don't have a chance too much to get back and talk about our service in Washington, but I appreciate you coming, and I hope this helps.
Oh, yes, it does, and I consider it a true honor and a pleasure to be in your company, and I thank you for that so much.
As I say in some of my speeches, I dine with kings and dance with queens, but this was my greatest moment, talking to you.
Thank you so much. All right, Kika. Tom Wilmer reporting from the Lower Rio Grande Valley in Texas. Ben Nighthorse Campbell. Tall and chiseled with a razor-sharp mind, 80-year-old Campbell still sports his trademark ponytail in honor of his Native American, Cheyenne, Pueblo, and Apache ancestry. Come along and join me as we visit with Ben Nighthorse Campbell as he recalls a very different time in the House and Senate in Washington, D.C.
Some of the best friendships I ever saw were, for instance, Al Simpson and Ted Kennedy. Good personal friends, you know, go play golf on a weekend or something, and they might argue a point on the floor, but that didn't affect their fondness for each other at all. And it's too bad it can't be that way now. I think what's happened with the condensation of information, people used to come in our office to visit us or write a letter. Mm-hmm. Now they want to put it right in your BlackBerry and get an immediate answer. And a lot of their actions are driven by constituent groups, single issue, way off to the right, way off to the left, something of that nature, you know. And those groups usually don't represent anybody except their own narrow interests. They don't represent what's fair.
Greater good.
Yeah, what they really want is rubber stamp obedience to their agenda. And anybody that does that isn't worth their salt in elected office, I don't think. But some of them are being driven to that.
We're speaking with Ben Nighthorse Campbell, retired United States Senator and Congressman.
Yeah, I was in Congress for 3 terms before the Senate. Then I was in the state legislature in Colorado 2 terms before that.
Looking back on your career in both Senate and the House, what are you most proud of that you accomplished?
I was fortunate that I did pass a lot of legislation, had a lot of legislation signed into law. In fact, the 102nd, 103rd, somewhere been some years ago, I had more legislation signed into law than anybody in the Senate or the House.
Thoughts on the Republican Party today, better or worse?
I think worse, but I think the Democrats are worse too, because they're both getting polarized and driven by what's called the base. The base usually is maybe 20% of the voters, but they tend to control that party with a very strong ideology to the right or the left.
That's the most mind-blowing thing. You have 70% consensus of populace on something, and there they are voting against.
That's right. Yeah, and that's a shame to see that happening.
Do you think there's hope?
There's always hope. It's not looking very good. Now it's getting to a point where if you have a friend across the aisle, you're criticized by your own side of the aisle. Mm-hmm. When they have the caucuses, they want everybody to be a good soldier and vote for the way the leadership goes, no matter whether you believe it or not, or whether you think it's good for your state or not. They want your subservience to that goal. Both sides do it, and I think it's wrong. That is also why good senators like Olympia Snowe and people of that caliber had enough. They're quitting.
That is the real tragedy. The best and brightest know better than to get chewed up.
That's right. The ones that really want to find solutions get beat up so badly after a while, they say, oh, who needs this? I'm out of here.
Ben Nighthorse Campbell, former United States Senator, it has been an absolute pleasure to visit with you.
Appreciate spending time with you.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Arizona.
And this is Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Still ahead on today's program, part two of our Ears on Art conversation with Cuesta College teacher and artist Bob Pelfrey. This week focuses on his teaching, with special attention to his conviction that the study of art history is the study of connections. But up first, Marisa Waddell talks with Pacific Wildlife Care about how they help animals on the Central Coast.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. What do you do when you come across an injured or orphaned wild animal? It's something that happens pretty frequently on the Central Coast because of where we live. There's an organization that can help in such situations. It's Pacific Wildlife Care, and their mission is to rehabilitate all kinds of wild animals and return them to their natural environment, and also to educate the rest of us about wildlife. My guests today are three women from Pacific Wildlife Care and one Western screech owl named Misty. With me are Marcel Bakula, who is the vice president of Pacific Wildlife Care, Virginia Flaherty, who is a wildlife rehabilitator, and she brought Misty with her, and Charmaine Coimbra, who is the organizer of a fundraiser coming up for Pacific Wildlife Care. It's called the Grand Ole Superbration, and we'll hear about that in just a little bit. Welcome to all three of you.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
And that's Misty that you're hearing flapping in the background. I think I'll start with you, Marcel, about the background and the mission of Pacific Wildlife Care. Can you give me a little idea of what it is that you do?
Sure. Well, let me start by saying that like any place in the world, there are always people who love animals, who care about animals, who see animals as a valuable part of our environment. And those people came together in an organization called the Central Coast Rehabilitators Guild. It was just a loose group of people who were permitted by Fish and Game and the various agencies that you need to be licensed by, and began to do home rehab. So from years and years and years, we had home rehabbers. And then as the county has grown and as more interactions with people and wildlife have occurred, the numbers got too great where people couldn't just have this amazing number of animals at their home without maybe getting ourselves into trouble. So they envisioned having an actual center. And so the center, with a lot of hard work, was built with many organizations and agencies involved. And starting in spring of 2007, they began to take animals in at the center, almost like an ER room. And at that point, we were seeing maybe 800 or 900 animals a year. And within that first couple years, we were up to 1,000, 1,200, 1,500. Last year was 2,300 animal wildlife cases that have come in.
Wow.
Now, we don't do marine mammals. That's a separate organization, the Marine Mammal Center.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few animals that we are not licensed because we don't have the correct housing and ability to, you know, handle adult bears or cougars, you know, but there are organizations that do that. We've gotten in baby bears and taken them to the proper Tahoe group to mm-hmm. do it. But now we've got the center. Now we've got 2,300 cases, or sometimes maybe only 1,700 or 1,800 in a year, but, you know, a lot of cases that we have to handle.
So, Virginia, you are sitting here with beautiful Misty, who's a little western screech owl. She is just gorgeous. How big is she?
She weighs about 160 grams, and she's about 6-7 inches tall, and she's a female western screech owl. So she's the bigger between the male and the female. Male would be considerably smaller, about a third smaller than she is. And a lot of people look at her because she looks so much like a great horned owl and think they've found a baby great horned owl. But in fact, she's an adult western screech owl. So she's just one of the smallest owls we have in the county.
And she has brown and white and black speckled.
Yeah, she's perfectly feathers. Camouflaged. If she were up against a tree trunk, if I put her up against a tree, you would not be able to see her. She's mm-hmm. beautifully camouflaged, and she has just molted. So she's got all new feathers, and she's looking particularly lovely these days.
She certainly is. And you can see a picture of her on the KCBX Facebook page. Can you tell us a little bit about her story and how she came to uh-huh. Pacific Wildlife Care?
She came to us about 2 years ago, and she was hit by a car up on Old Creek Road in Cayucas. And the person who found her was just driving up the road and found her on the side of the road and thought she was a rock, actually, until she moved. And the person who rescued her is actually named Misty. That's who she's named after. Mm-hmm. And she picked her up and brought her into us. And sometimes in that case, if an animal like this has been hit by a car, they can recuperate and regain their eyesight. But in her case, she was never able to do that. So she is completely blind in both eyes. And she's probably got a little bit of a head injury as well, because she's very calm for a screech owl. Most screech owls are little maniacs, but she's quite calm and easygoing and makes a great educational animal for that reason.
Marcel, can you please tell us a little bit about the education team?
There are 7 people on the education team, and I think right now we have 8 or 9 animals. And last year they did 115 presentations at schools and organizations and events.
We make them work for their living.
They're only required to do 12. Each animal has to do 12 presentations a year to have the permit to have them, but they do well over that. They really work a lot, and I think it's an important part of the education process.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guests are from Pacific Wildlife Care. They're Marcel Bakula and Virginia Flaherty and Charmaine Coimbra. And we're here to talk about what it is that Pacific Wildlife Care does, and also to talk a little bit about the Grand Ole Soupabration, which is a fundraiser coming up on October 20th at Camp Ocean Pines in Cambria. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But first, I'd like to know a little bit more about what kinds of animals you rehabilitate. I've seen everything from bats to deer to hawks on your website.
It's always different. Mm-hmm. And we, I think, had over 143 species last year that we saw.
And in any given day, you can get a golden eagle in 1 minute, and 10 minutes later, a hummingbird or
yesterday, that was exactly what we had yesterday. I was at the center yesterday. We got in a hummingbird and a golden eagle. How'd you know, Virginia?
I don't know. That was a good guess on my part.
And pelicans, sometimes you go into you come up and they're in flight one, which is a long, was it 60, 75
90
foot flight?
90 foot.
90 foot flight? Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. There were at least 25 pelicans in there, and each pelican cost $300 for a month's worth of fish.
Wow.
So when you've got 20 inside and 20 outside, it's Pelican City, and fish, it smells like fish in there too. most of the animals in the county we would take. 80% of our cases are birds.
Are there any circumstances when it's not appropriate to rehabilitate an animal?
Only if we feel that they're not releasable, and then they cannot be used for education. if there's something, an injury that's happened to them, for instance, if we get a bird of prey in that needs to be able to fly perfectly and they have a broken wing and it doesn't heal perfectly, then in that case we would not continue with the rehabilitation. So our goal is to rescue, rehabilitate, and release orphaned and injured wildlife. And if an animal we know won't be able to survive in the wild, then we would not rehabilitate it.
Tell me what it takes to rehabilitate a bird, for instance. So you've got Misty in your hand and you've been looking after her.
We start off right away by drawing blood to get their blood levels and know what state they're in, if they've been starving for a while or if they've got other issues with parasites and things like that, to try to figure out why they've come in. Sometimes it's not always obvious. And then we go from there, and it often requires us to tube feed birds initially when they come in and then gradually work up to regular food. For, in that situation, for an owl or a bird of prey, they have one eye and we want to live hunt them. We also live hunt baby hawks or juveniles that come in who have we're raising for some reason. And what we'll do is we'll put a live mouse in a trough in front of them and give the mouse lots of places to hide. And we'll put the bird in the flight with that trough and see if they can catch that mouse in that trough. Mm-hmm. And so that's a start. And sometimes with juveniles, it takes them a while to realize that that's food, actually, that they, you know, that's what they need to be looking for when they're out in the wild. So mm-hmm. it's really important that they recognize what their food source is. Mm-hmm.
What do you recommend someone does if they come across an orphaned or injured animal in the wild?
Well, whenever we do any kind of education with kids and families and all that, we tell them that they need to contact us. We have people who sometimes will use the internet and they think they know what kind of animal they have, and somewhere on the internet it tells them that this is a meat-eating animal. So we have a perfect case of a beautiful young barn owl that had fallen out of a nest, and some children looked up that they were meat. They eat meat. So they fed them hamburger during crucial growing period of time when they needed to have the entire animal with the bones to get the calcium and the phosphorus. So that poor owl developed metabolic bone disease. It had deformed wings and deformed legs. Well, first of all, it's illegal for anyone to have wildlife. So they can't have it to begin with. So they need to get it to us. I mean, that's really in our county the only thing you can do. You can also call just to get advice. Maybe you have something that's moved into your attic or moved under your deck. And we have an exclusion, a humane exclusion program. And our people will go out and look at the situation, tell you how to get the animal out humanely and move on, you know, so it goes back into the wild so that you're not trapping and having to kill it. Any animals that are trapped in our county must be euthanized. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not allowed to be relocated. So anytime anyone has any situation, we want them to call our hotline, which is 543-WILD. We've had that number for 25 years, 543-WILD. And the wild is 9453. And we would want them to get advice, ask questions, bring the animal to the center. If they can't bring it, we'll try to get someone to come and get it and bring it in. I have to say right now that the most amazing thing has happened this year. I'm very, very, very excited. Someone gave us a grant to hire a wildlife veterinarian. And San Luis County's never had a wildlife veterinarian, ever. And so this year, we not only have this wildlife veterinarian who is an expert in birds, which really helps. She loves birds. And so we had wonderful relationships with other vets in the county, you know, dog and cat vets, who helped us out as best that they could. But by having a surgical center at the center, there at our rehab center, to have an amazing, amazing digital x-ray machine, which we also got from another wonderful, generous source. At this point, instead of our typical 40% survival rate, we're up to close to 60, which is unheard of in the state.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas, and I'm talking with some folks from Pacific Wildlife Care. You mentioned earlier that it takes about $300
per bird.
For
pelicans. They're just hearty eaters. You know those big pouches? They, you know, scoop up the fish in large quantities. Yeah. And then we have other animals that are expensive. Our peregrine falcon, which is an animal that we'll have for, I don't know, 25, 30 years probably, it's one of the more expensive animals to keep and feed.
It takes some funding to pay for rehabilitating these animals. There are various ways that you receive your funding. You mentioned a grant for the veterinarian.
That was a one-year, one-time grant, so now we're having a Fund a Vet campaign out to our members. We have what we call members, and members are really anyone who's being willing to donate to us, and sometimes they'll donate to us every year, so they get a gentle reminder that their membership is up, much like KCBX.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have a fundraiser.
Yes, you have a few different fundraisers.
I guess I better mention that since Charmaine came all this way down from Cambria to talk about it. We have several fundraisers, and I want to bring up that Virginia business has generously donated a kayak trip, and they're going to be having that the day before Charmaine's event for another fundraiser. So we want to make sure we mention both of those, and those are ways to get us some additional funding.
So Charmaine, you have been sitting here patiently while we talk all about Pacific Wildlife Care and Misty the Owl, and you have an event that you've organized that's coming up very soon, the Grand Ole Superbration. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, that's set for Sunday, October the 20th. It starts at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and ends at 5:30. I am absolutely focused on making this a super event. So we have 12 chefs who will be competing for the best soups around. This isn't going to be your mama's chicken soup. These are soups that will make you just go, oh my goodness, I've never tasted anything like it. Mm-hmm. You know, a lemongrass-based soup in an herb roux, or winter squash soup that's just filled with brown butter. And they're not necessarily low-calorie soups, but they are absolutely artisan creations by these outrageous chefs, all the way from San Luis Obispo to San Simeon. Mm-hmm. So we also have wineries. We have food purveyors who will be showcasing artisan chocolates. Mama Ganache will be there. We have Red Moose cookies. It's the best cookie you'll ever have in your life. You can't eat just one, and their cookies are about 6 inches in diameter, so it's not a dietary food by any means. And Chef Dakota Weiss has a line of gourmet popcorn that ranges from ghost chili and lime-flavored popcorn to fried chicken and waffle popcorn. There's going to be music. We have silent auctions. We will have our showcase silent auction item will be a private dinner with Chef Weiss, who will prepare the dinner, and it will take place at Sculptera Winery. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a great event.
The wildlife animals will be there, too.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We'll have wildlife
Misty will
ambassadors.
Be there, yes.
When you come to the door, you'll be greeted by an owl. And every half hour, an animal will pop up someplace. Mm-hmm. People will have a wonderful opportunity to sip soup, enjoy, and learn more about what Pacific Wildlife Care does.
And this, again, is on October 20th, 2 to 5:30 at Camp Ocean Pines in Cambria. And then the other event that's coming up is just the day before, on October 19th. And that sounds really fun. It's a kayak trip across Morro Bay to the dunes.
It is, yes. And we did one in September, which was really successful, beautiful evening. And we're doing another one coming up the day before the Superbration. And basically, we're doing a kayak trip that starts right down at the State Park Marina kayak docks. And we'll start out with our educational animals there as well. And then we'll get into the boats and do a short paddle on the bay for about an hour, and then eventually head over to the sand spit, and we do a full barbecue dinner out on the sand spit. So it's a really unique experience, and the money goes to Pacific Wildlife Care. And the cost is $125 per person.
Okay.
And I guess the best way to go find out about that is to either go to Pacific Wildlife Care's website or to Central Coast Outdoors' website, and it's on there under the Dinner on the Dunes trip.
If someone wants to help Pacific Wildlife Care in any way, you mentioned becoming a member. There are these events. What are some other ways that people can help?
Every other month, just about every other month. We do a couple that are in months in a row, but we have volunteer opportunities orientations. And it's an opportunity to just spend 1 hour with us and find out about what all the different ways are you can volunteer. And we rely heavily on volunteers. I think we have over 150 volunteers at this point. And we need volunteers to work at the center. We need volunteers who help with the phones to answer people's calls. And we need help with transporting animals, you know, from wherever they're found to getting them to the center. That's probably the best, you know, thing would be to call the 543 WILD number or to check the website, and it's pacificwildlifecare.org.
Okay, 543-WILD or pacificwildlifecare.org. And thank you so much to Misty for coming and flapping around in the background as we've been chatting. Misty the screech owl, and you can see a picture of her on the KCBX Facebook page, which is KCBX FM. Thank you so much, all of you from Pacific Wildlife Care, Marcel Bakula, Charmaine Coimbra, and Virginia Flaherty, and of course, Misty.
Thank you, Marissa.
Thank you.
For Issues and Ideas, I'm Marissa Waddell.
And you are listening to Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Up next on the program, Ears on Art continues its conversation with Cuesta College teacher and artist Bob Pelfrey. Ears on Art is sponsored by Marshall's Jewelers, creating and selling fine jewelry since 1889. You can visit them on the corner of Higuera and Garden Streets in downtown San Luis Obispo.
We continue our discussion with Bob Pelfrey with a special guest who just happened to be a former student of his. Stay tuned. Hi there. I am Stephen DeLuque, and along with Chrissa Hewitt, the producers and hosts of this program, Ears on Art, which is a segment of Issues and Ideas, produced at the studios of listener-supported public radio station KCBX, serving the Central California coast from Salinas to Ventura. Chrissa and I present the second half of our conversation with one of the founding fathers of the art curriculum at Cuesta College, Bob Pelfrey. As part of the 50th anniversary celebration at Cuesta College, the three founders, Chet Amix, Barry France, and Bob Pelfrey, were honored with solo shows. More about that later. Now, to Bob with a visit from one of his former students.
That can't be Guy, right? You've made it!
I made it!
Talking about the early days, and Guy, you were not that bald then.
I had less hair.
I had black hair like a rock star.
Reminded me of one, too.
Guy Rathman's part in this story will become evident very shortly, but we are going to begin where we left off last week, with Bob discussing how his dreams play such an important role in his artwork.
I mean, I see my art as really an extension of a process. For me, my instant dreams originated in a kind of therapeutic mode, life crisis thing. So art, for me, anything catching the stream of life, is not so much a composition as that gives you, if you were fishing or if you were at a river, that was the weather, that was how the flow of my life was at that time. So the stylistic thing is not particularly consistent. I have a few very realistic things, and I have some that are very expressionistic. But the main energy comes from the dream journal that I keep on a regular basis.
I'm not sure that we've had too many people on this show for all these years talk about creating things and ripping them up.
I do a lot of drawing, which fortunately you can store a lot of it because I don't exhibit. I'm just not a good businessman. And I'm not interested in doing the hard work it takes to try to get some gallery. I would love to do it. I'm just not good at it. And so why do I do it? I do this because it is, if anything, a kind of yoga for me, doing art. It's fine with me if I spend all day drawing and it sucks. I just rip it up. And I don't have this huge investment and responsibility, say, I have to have a show next year. That's the payoff for being a teacher. And I don't have to depend on exhibiting or selling my work. So it may sound a little bit self or narcissistic to somebody hearing that, but it's the opposite in many ways. It means that somebody who really loves to play tennis or something and is hugely meaningful to their life, they don't expect people to pay money to come watch them. I don't see my art as something that I have to show. I do it, and then if I have a chance to show it, I'm delighted. Most of my art also isn't stuff people want to put in their living rooms, you know, because it's my dream. Since I insist on working with my dream, I have to live with the consequences of that. And that is, it would take a very specialized, say, gallery that would have clients who would be interested in looking at images that become so subjective. In other words, I'm very happy doing the art that I do.
We've discussed this with a couple of artists and the fact that it's the process that's important.
Yes.
And it's the product that is not as important. And it's part of the journey as an artist is that this is how we express ourselves. This is part of our conversation with the world.
Yes.
And for me anyway, once the image is down, I don't have much interest in it because I've learned what I had to do from by creating the image. And after that, it's like I don't consider it precious at that point. And if somebody else appreciates it, fine. But that's not my primary goal.
You said it better and more succinctly than I just tried to do, right? That's exactly what I meant. So thank you. Yeah, it's my process and it's self-justifying.
I'm just realizing that I've referred to my process, which is certainly not one of become famous or have a constant gallery presence, is probably an aspect of a selfishness that just says, this is very important to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I need, on a certain level, to be able to do it on my own terms.
Mm-hmm.
The teaching part then fulfills, fortunately, a very significant other part of who I am. Obviously, it's nice to have somebody respond positively to what I do, but that's a lot of, I don't know, it's heavy stuff, but it's very real.
Mm-hmm.
Bob, we've talked about the importance to you of teaching, and we now have another guest at the table, Guy Rathbun.
I'm a guest?
No.
No.
What is he, Steve?
He's an honored guest.
Yeah.
That'll teach you.
Well, thank you, Chris.
When I mentioned to Guy or Stephen and I would be interviewing you, and he started to reminisce. So I think it would be fun to have the two of you start where you picked up your acquaintance. So what year was that?
I'm going to say 1973, and you might call me a returning student. Just to put perspective on this, since we can't see faces, Bob was a younger teacher, and I was an older student. Okay.
Very good. And by the way, before we get involved in this, I want everyone to know I taught Guy everything he knows. His entire success is due to those early... Actually, if I remember correctly, and Guy, you please correct me. By the way, I love Guy's voice. Every time I hear him on KCBX and so on, that velvety, avuncular, trusting voice is amazing. And it was always there, right? But anyway, my recollection, Guy, is that you were in a mixed media class that I taught.
That was the second semester I was in one of your classes.
Yes, but another person who was in that class was Bill Morum.
Yes.
And Bill Morum also, I taught him everything he knows. And there's a theme here going. You see, if I was a little reticent about my art, you can see I'm not that way about my teaching. But anyway, that is a wonderful memory because it shows you how primal and primitive that class was. Because we used to do things like reel-to-reel tapes. We used to create slides out of transparencies.
Just threw mine away.
You just threw yours away? What, your collection of slides from that?
Yes.
Oh, my God, the Smithsonian would have won.
2 months ago.
It was such a fun class. And in fact, getting into my teaching career, I many times had to learn something really quickly because I'm not a media person. I was interested in media and theory. I was a McLuhan-esque. That's how I approached my art appreciation. These guys were great. They're older students. I mean, compared to, remember, I have a background in public high school, and those people deserve medals. It is. I would love some of our Republican critiques of public education to take my daughter's high school class in Ventura for a week. I would love to see Mitt Romney teach that class. He would be running out screaming. But anyway, to actually get to the community college and to have middle-aged students, returning students from the Vietnam War, just appreciative to be there and the chance to earn credit and to do things. It was just, it was wonderful. And Guy was there when we had to step aside from the cow flops to get from one mm-hmm. building to another. But it was great fun.
Okay, Guy, I'm going to put you on the spot because you did tell me a story a week ago.
Yes.
I mean, it's a story on you, Bob. So
has the statute of limitations.
Well, we'll see. Remember, we can edit.
Well, one of my favorite memories, and I think I've expressed this to Bob before, in my years of college, I went on beyond Bob's class, even though by the time I was through with Bob's class, I didn't need another class. But I went on, and I mean this quite seriously. Like I say, I think I told Bob this. In all of my years, he was one of three who held that level of being an exceptional professor. I mean, he did it with a genuine sense of love for teaching, a knowledge of his subject, and even more importantly, he got into what he was teaching. I mean, he became what he was teaching. And so when I heard that Krissa would be interviewing you, Bob, I said, I have to tell you this story. And I told it to her, and she said, do you think you'd like to relate this in the show? And I said, yeah, I don't know if Bob would appreciate it.
Yeah. Let's see what happens.
You don't know the story?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
That way I can have deniability. So go ahead.
Before we hear the story, I want to let you know that you're listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. Stephen and my guest today is Bob Pelfrey, artist and retired Cuesta College art professor. Joining us in the conversation is Guy Rathbun, currently an independent radio producer. Okay, so what's the story?
Well, got into class for the early movies. You wanted to show us the early movies, and some of the students there had no idea what silent movies were. And so the movie we were going to see was the original uncut version of King Kong. Okay. Uncut because there's this one really suggestive scene in there where it's obvious that King Kong has mad lust for Fay Wray. Not just a love interest. Mm-hmm. It was pure lust. And while this tiny woman is in his massive paw, he starts removing her already diaphanous outfit piece by piece. And his expressions, these mechanical expressions, come on to this monster, gorilla, that are unmistakably funny.
Lecherous.
Lecherously funny. Laughter started coming from the back of the room, and it increased. And we turn around and look in the back, and there's Bob laughing so hard, so genuinely, that we all started laughing, and then tears were running down his face. He put his head on the desk like, I can't handle this. And it's just so memorable.
Oh, God.
And that, just, to me, told the story of who you are. You love what you do.
Well, I also think it shows something else. I'm sure the reason I was laughing so much is that it was the wrong reel, right? Because it sounds like a film that I probably would have decided maybe this isn't the best film to show, you know, because it sounds like a...
No.
But
It was the unexpurgated portion.
Of course it was.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't think there was a Hayes office back then, but they pulled it. Someone pulled that and said, you cannot show that to the public.
The thing I do remember showing in that class was Bambi Meets Godzilla or something. Uh-huh.
I love that short.
Has made its rounds and so on. So I showed all kinds of stuff, Guy. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I sometimes surprise myself.
We were talking last week about Bob's enjoyment of making connections for students with history, with whatever. Mm-hmm. Besides King Kong, do you have memories of how the parts were put together?
The parts of how King Kong came about?
No, just...
This can't be an episode.
We cannot go there.
No, I hope not.
We cannot go there.
Do you wish to rephrase that?
No. Oh. You want to ask this question?
See, here we go again. Yeah. It sounds like the original story.
I think so.
It's even more dangerous in my hands.
Sure. Okay. My experience with art history classes was not good. They tended to bore me. They tended to require that I make a whole lot of notes about stuff that somehow that was what was going to be tested. Could I remember the name and the date, and the worst one was a 1 o'clock class gone.
Nap time.
I've had a couple of good experiences, but I keep wishing I had had more. So, Guy, what kept you awake in Bob's class?
Actually, I'm really interested. Bob and I have never had any personal conversations.
No, about.
But I'm not surprised in coming into this interview hearing that he does dream journaling and work. His work is from his dreams. It doesn't surprise me at all, because what kept me alert in that class was that Bob wasn't looking for us to remember dates. In fact, I don't recall he even cared if we got the spelling of Botticelli correct. That wasn't the point. The point was to see inside the art. And so if there was an abstraction inside a 15th century piece of art, Bob brought it out. And he showed us that this elongated skull at the bottom of the painting has depth of meaning that we may never understand. But here is possibly what it means. And I hung on. I'm serious. That
no,
just,
that's a good example.
I said, ah, I would never, ever in my wildest dreams seen this piece of work this way. So, yeah, that kept me alert.
Well, I can give a little follow-up to that, because that is how I would like to be remembered in terms of art history. I refused, even when we get into the digital, you can put all kinds of text with paintings. Mm-hmm. And let's take St. Francis in Ecstasy, which mm-hmm. to me is one of the 10 great paintings for me. Everyone agrees it is, all right? But I want people to look at that painting with no text, no titles, to distract them from just looking at the painting. Then, at some point, you turn the lights on something and you give them some notes, or you pass out a handout and you tell them what you want them to remember. Mm-hmm. But while a painting is on the screen, I think the impact of the painting is paramount, including that wonderful Holbein you're talking about with the skull, the French ambassadors,
yes,
which is so fascinating.
As I recall, and he had a way of teaching that felt like it was more involved for me as a student. And I think it's called the Socratic method, although not precisely along those lines. Bob would ask us what we see here. You'd turn around and say, what do you see? And so eventually, as we started coming out of our cocoons of being trapped inside what we thought was authority to subordinate, we started talking about it. And the livelier the class got because of the discussions, the more that came out.
How big were those classes?
You know, the art history would be 35 or 40, but the studio classes, including the infamous, you know, Bill Morham, Guy Rathman, and I won't mention some of the other names, unwanted posters, we might have 12 students. So we would show up and we'd get whatever level of technology we're working on that media class, and we'd have a very small class. It was just wonderful that way. But the lecture courses, we didn't have a big forum at all. So the biggest class would be 35 or 40. It was really a luxury. I'll give you an example of how those funky Quonset huts were great. But there's an effect called the camera obscura, where you have a pinhole camera and an outside view is projected upside down inside. Well, I noticed in one of the rooms I taught, one spring morning I looked up and I realized it was this long, narrow band. And I realized, my God, that's a slightly extended image of the outside. There was a knothole. And so I had so much fun. I would wait for that point in the semester when we talk about the camera obscura and the invention of photography. Leonardo da Vinci actually invented one. And I would say, by the way, has anyone noticed the camera obscura in this room? And, of course, that's when I would come off like the genius, right?
Yeah. Saying,
well, just look at the rim, that image up there, and you see that person coming towards the door. She'll walk in a minute, and she's upside down, of course, mm-hmm. and a woman walks in the room. So those are wonderful moments.
Oh, yes.
And
you couldn't get
with
that.
New buildings, you know, you're never going to get a camera obscura demo simply because the funky wood is rotten.
Yeah. Those were some good memories.
Oh, yeah.
It really was.
Oh, yeah.
People laugh when they see the pictures of those barracks, but there were experiences there that made it very worthwhile.
When I was at Cal Poly in 76, 77, we used to have the ceramics classes in what we called then the cardboard jungle, which is where the Kennedy Library is now, and it was the same type of thing. It was World War II leftover buildings, and they were falling apart. But that's what they gave you.
Roger Bailey's office was his closet, literally a closet, and he somehow jammed a desk in there so he could close the door so the desk was secured, but his chair would be outside his office.
I think yours was kind of a cloakroom or something.
It was a wooden door that opened up to a little back room, a large closet.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I'm going back to the statement about not needing to know all the spellings or all the dates. Still probably my best art history, art appreciation course, which was in high school. And that teacher did very much the same thing. And her hope was is that we could know a basic time period. It was Picasso here and somebody else, whatever. And the L.A. County Museum had just opened up its brand new facility on Wilshire. And we went on a field trip. My museum exposure had mostly been in Chicago on train layovers when my family would cross the country. And as a 5, 6, 7-year-old, bored, silly, got off the elevator in the L.A. County Museum and looked across and went, I know who did that. It was a Modigliani painting. It was a really exciting moment. Very fortunate students that you've been having all these years. I know, Guy, your love of history, so it seems that that connection and being able to connect dots would have definitely been an appeal.
Definitely, but you know, interesting, before I got to Cuesta College, I wasn't interested in history. Is that odd? Because it was a case of a whole bunch of wooden people moving around. I was in one class. He would look at the podium and say whatever he had to say, and he'd say, that happened in 1747. And then he would look up and say, write that down. And then, bong, right back to the podium, not even look at the students.
Classic.
And, yeah, I couldn't take that. But I got into Bob's class, and his characters were alive. They were part of, they were living, breathing people. And that's a big, big difference. Never had a teacher bring these people to life. So they were just uninteresting to me.
One of the artworks that I found really fascinating that accomplished what you said, you were applying the artist to their period and what they did, was Judy Chicago's Dinner Party.
Oh, wow.
It was a fantastic work, but each of those place settings was done in the style of when that person was alive. And I remember reading about it thinking, this is so much more than art. You know, this is relating art to when it was created and how it was created and the people who lived at that time. And that really resonated with me.
I agree. In fact, that seeing that piece, I mean, there's a great example because Chris was talking about the, and I did too, the slide. Then you go to the reality, how it can be just overwhelming despite your expectation. And very irritated at Judy Chicago because you had to wait in line. Only a certain number could go in. And I said, what is this, church? When I went in, I didn't want to be pushed. I didn't want to have tons of people over my shoulder. I stopped at each plate, and that was a fabulous experience of art. And she was correct to say, this is how I want people to see, to experience this piece. Not only is it so significant at its cultural moment, it's set up like a Eucharist or like a, you know, a Last Supper type thing. And to see it slightly ritually really forces you to confront each plate, and then you really experience the presence that's evoked by each plate.
Yeah.
It was a marvelous thing.
You were teaching an art appreciation and then even some of these media-type classes. Were you also doing more conventional art history?
Yes.
And what kind of time frame did that cover?
Well, the conventional, we had 4 art history courses. Barry has always kept up the non-Western. And then I would teach ancient and then Renaissance to modern. And Chet would often teach the 20th century. So we had art history, which is, you know, historical, chronological, and data-driven. And then we had art appreciation, which is a one-semester course, the only art course presumably they'll take, because art majors have to take art history. And so you try to get as much as you can in one semester, knowing that that's going to be it. That's their whole college exposure to art. And so I did a mixture of art history and other subjects that I felt were intriguing enough or interesting enough to throw in, including television. I know that I was one of the earliest art instructors to insist that television commercials, much as we despise them, are an art form in our culture. And so I would always show a couple of lectures just on television commercials. Television in general was a component of my art appreciation approach, because if the visual images that influence behavior is one definition of art, of many, but it, certainly Chartres Cathedral was a tremendous propaganda vehicle for the political religious order of the Middle Ages. Television itself reinforces everything about our value system and our political system, and mostly capitalism. So I worked that in too, and tried to compare the television environment to the, say, the cathedral environment, or the Roman, the city of Rome as a propaganda complex. I mean, Rome was unbelievably spectacular.
Seems that current day now we're preoccupied with the assessment process and the test. How did you structure exams so that you could get a sense if people were getting what you hoped that they were?
I know I couldn't teach high school with the emphasis on testing and statewide standards and things that take up, mostly because they take up so much time, and people teach for the test, which I think is self-destructive. I probably gave 10 or 15 tests during the semester, and a combination of journal where they could write their appreciation of something. They had to read the textbook, and they had to be there for the lectures. And then I took attendance. Some of them said it was like high school, and I said, deal with it, because if they want credit in my course, they're going to be there. So Guy's description is right, that I was mostly interested in the aesthetic experience of art and giving them some very general ideas like what television is. But they can't just show up and say, gee, I dig your class, right? There were multiple choice tests as well as essay tests in my art appreciation. But I didn't belabor it. I didn't say they had to be able to distinguish 10 of Caravaggio's paintings and date them correctly in chronological order, which is what I was taught at UCLA, and I hated it. But they better know what the dates of Caravaggio are.
Do you remember kinds of things that you were doing in that studio class?
Oh, yes. I was interestingly enough, a Roman newscaster. We dressed in toga. You remember that? Yes. Oh, I do recall.
We had to shut Guy up, or Gaius, as we call him.
Yeah, that's Gaius. And the great part of that class is we, as students, had to be involved in it. It wasn't we were shown what Super 8 was, and then move on to the next. We had to function sensibly with these pieces of equipment.
Bob, is there anything here that we haven't touched on at all
that we need to make sure we do? I feel like the CIA has debriefed me, and that in case I am a sleeper cell terrorist trying to keep something away, I think you guys have it all there, so I just ask you to be merciful.
Bob, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate your coming. And this is to Barry. I love talking about art. I don't see the problem.
And Guy, it's been very special having you here.
Thank you very much for the invite. Appreciate that.
Thank you both. It's been great. You have just listened to the completion of a conversation with Bob Pelfrey, one of the three founders of Cuesta College's art department. The three have been honored with individual shows in conjunction with Cuesta College's 50th anniversary. Bob Pelfrey's show opens on October 16th and runs through November 8th. The gallery is open Monday through Friday from noon until 4 p.m. There is an artist's reception on October 18th from 4 to 7 p.m. with a presentation by Professor Pelfrey at 5:30. For the next two weekends, October 12th and 13th, and October 19th and 20th, there is the Open Studios Art Tour, a countywide display of over 230 artists opening their studios to the public. Open Studios Art Tour is sponsored by Arts Obispo, To find out about the tour, which is free to the public, visit artsobispo.org. You have been listening to Ears on Art, produced at the studios of listener-supported public radio, KCBX, in San Luis Obispo, California. This is Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krista Hewitt, thank you for listening.